The sage's understanding of nature is amazingly profound and total. In fact, the Stoic sage has infallible knowledge of what should be done in every situation. The sage takes the right steps at the right times and does them in the right way to accomplish the right goal. But is Yoda a Stoic who acts from reason in every situation? No. Yoda feels the force guiding his action and the counsels he gives. Qui-Gon says to Anakin, "Feel. Don't think. Use your instincts." Obi-Wan tells Luke, "Trust your feelings." So the character traits that make reason possible for a Stoic resemble the traits that make it possible for Jedi like Yoda to feel and harness the Force. In Star Wars, of course, there is also a dark side of the Force. Darth Vader and the Emperor also harness the Force to achieve their goals. How does the dark side shape Darth Vader and the Emperor? What makes them evil if Yoda is supposed to be good? The logic of the dark side. To answer these questions, we must reconstruct the logic of the dark side of the Force. Here again, the contrast between appearance and reality reveals clues. In Qui-Gon's first meeting with the Jedi Council, Yoda observes, "Hard to see, the dark side is. Is this double entendre intended as a joke or a serious insight?" In any case, it well describes how the Emperor appears. His head and face are hidden inside a dark hooded cloak. Like the dark side itself, the Emperor is hard to see and an obvious foil to Yoda. Both Yoda and the Emperor are ascetic devotees of the Force. Both wear simple robes. Neither is tempted by bodily pleasures. Both appear to live monkish lives of religious devotion. Is the Emperor merely evil? Or is his character more complex? The Emperor does seem to have several virtues. Like Yoda, the Emperor has a serious mind and the deepest commitment, though his is to the dark side. The Emperor is the master of the dark side, and this surely must count as a kind of supremacy. Moreover, in Return of the Jedi, the Emperor urges patience on Vader in his search for Luke, a virtue Yoda shares. In these respects, the Emperor and Yoda appear to be similar. How are they really different? A few scenes later, the Emperor says that Luke's compassion for his father will be his undoing. The Emperor sees compassion as a weakness, not a strength, a vice, not a virtue. The Stoics rejected compassion as irrational, taking on the disturbing passion, pathos, of someone who is miserable makes you miserable too. So it's foolish to be misery's company by feeling compassion. Unlike the Emperor, however, the Stoics thought that it's virtuous to show compassion to others by acting to help them. Doing things to help others is beneficence. Beneficence can be motivated by philanthropy, kindness, or simple recognition of one's fellow beings as members of the community of rational persons in the cosmos we all inhabit. The ancient Greek Stoics originated this idea of a citizen of the universe, or cosmopolitan. The Emperor clearly has no such inclusive vision of the subjects populating his empire. So while the Emperor is correct, from a Stoic perspective, to reject the feeling of compassion as a weakness, he is wrong to be cruel by failing to show compassion to those he can help. From the Stoic perspective, his logic is twisted. But what twists it? What makes the dark side of the Force dark? Why think the Emperor is evil rather than simply eccentric or illogical? The logic of the dark side is glimpsed in the moving conversation between Luke and Vader. Vader wants to turn Luke to the dark side so that he will join Vader and the Emperor. Luke senses the moral conflict within Vader and wishes to turn his father back to the light side. Vader tells Luke, "You don't know the power of the dark side. I must obey my master." The Force is power that can be directed toward good or bad ends. Obi-Wan, Yoda, and all the good Jedi use the Force to achieve their goals. Vader and the Emperor do the same. Yoda says that the Force is his ally. Vader, however, is a servant of the dark side. Vader is in its power because he must obey his master, the Emperor. So the essence of the dark side is mastery over others, or tyranny. But the dark side limits the masters to only two Sith at a time, the master and the servant. When Vader brings Luke captive to the Emperor says he looks forward to completing Luke's training as his new master, and gloats about the trap he has set for Luke's friends on the moon of Endor. The Emperor goads Luke by urging him to take his lightsaber.
"You want this, don't you? The hate is swelling in you now. Take your Jedi weapon. Use it. I am unarmed. Strike me down with it. Give in to your anger. With each passing moment, you make yourself more my servant."
The Emperor continues to torment Luke, basking in his suffering.
"Good. I can feel your anger. I am defenseless. Take your weapon. Strike me down with all your hatred, and your journey toward the dark side will be complete."
When Luke is fighting Vader, the Emperor is pleased. He congratulates Luke for using his aggressive feelings and letting the hate flow through him.
"You, like your father, are now mine."
So in contrast to the logic of the light side, the logic of the dark side is this. 1. Anger leads to hatred. 2. Hatred leads to aggression aimed at the mastery of others. 3. Mastery of others is true power. 4. True power is irresistibly desirable. When Luke slashes off Vader's right hand with his lightsaber, the Emperor applauds Luke.
"Your hate has made you powerful."
But Luke refuses to kill Vader, as the Emperor wishes. "You failed, Your Highness. I am a Jedi, like my father before me." If mastery of others and enslavement to evil fails, then the dark logic demands destruction.
"If you will not be turned, you will be destroyed."
Consequently, the Emperor is a propagator of terror, hatred, and cruelty. He gloats and takes pleasure in the distress of others. The ancient Stoics were quite familiar with tyrants like Cambyses of Persia, Hippias of Athens, both 6th century BCE, and Gaius Caligula, 1st century CE. These tyrants, along with the evil Emperor Palpatine, can be usefully contrasted with the Stoic Marcus Aurelius, 121 to 180 CE, who ruled the Roman Empire from 161 to 180 CE. The benevolence and the rectitude of the Emperor Marcus is plain in his Meditations. The Stoic does not seek to exploit others. Rather, the Stoic aims at emotional self-sufficiency and cultivating his own mental discipline. This means that the Stoic sage has succeeded in mastering himself by having mastered his desires and having eliminated vice from his character. Luke is therefore urging Stoic wisdom upon Vader when he tells him to let go of his hate. Unfortunately, hatred has had such a vice-like hold on Vader for so long that he tells Luke,
"It is too late for me, son. The Emperor will show you the true nature of the Force. He is your master now."
For servants of the dark side, the true nature of the Force is servitude to evil, enslavement to hate. Like virtues, vices tend to control one's behavior. Vader has used fear and hatred to achieve his ends for so long that the superior hatred and aggression of the Emperor use him. This is how Vader's mastery of the dark side is at the same time servitude to it. The reality behind the monkish appearance of the Emperor is the soul of a monster afflicted by vice. On the other hand, the Emperor's hatred follows a cool logic of its own. His cruelty is calmly calculated, not haphazard. The Emperor shows an icy rationality and self-possession that is a shallow reflection of the Stoic's passionlessness. His is an arrogant rationality which seeks to dominate, exploit, and enslave people through careful planning and use of the dark side of the Force. As Luke warns him, "Your overconfidence is your weakness." According to Stoicism, however, the Emperor's cleverness, devotion, and self-possession are not virtues. As a tyrant, the Emperor's goal is to master things and people that are in fact beyond his control rather than to master himself by becoming virtuous. Since the Emperor fails to understand what is really good, namely virtue, and what is really bad, namely vice, he lacks Stoic wisdom. Since he lacks wisdom, he lacks all the virtues, and so he is full of vice. Since he has no desire to gain wisdom, his mind is fundamentally flawed, and his vice is incurable. As a consequence, when Vader throws him into the reactor shaft, he appears to die, suffering. Control, control, you must learn control. Yoda and the other Jedi use discipline, commitment, and training to control themselves, thereby harnessing the power of the Force. Vader and the Emperor, on the other hand, stoke their anger and hatred to empower themselves with the dark side of the Force. They feed, rather than overcome, the negative emotions within themselves. They seek to control not themselves, but others, in an ultimately doomed attempt to fill the cold, black void behind the mask or the hood with the false satisfaction that arises from domination and oppression of others. A Stoic could never be seduced by the dark side, but might well feel at home among the calm, self-disciplined, virtuous Jedi. But a Stoic indulges in none of the supernaturalism or mysticism expressed in some aspects of the Force in Star Wars. The wisdom of Yoda and the vices of the Emperor are illuminated nicely by the plain light of natural reason, provided by the Stoic philosophy. Chapter 3. The Far East of Star Wars. Walter Rutoku Robinson. The Force is central to the Star Wars mythology. In A New Hope, Obi-Wan Kenobi describes it as an energy field created by all living things. It surrounds us and penetrates us. It binds the galaxy together. This is an extremely good description of what is known in Chinese as Qi, or in Japanese as Ki. In the Star Wars galaxy, the Jedi use the Force in their fighting arts. A Jedi's strength flows from the Force, Yoda teaches Luke. In the martial arts of the Far East, Qi is cultivated to give special fighting advantage over someone who relies only on physical strength. Eastern philosophy, most especially philosophical Taoism and Zen Buddhism, plays a major role in the Star Wars mythology. This is most true in relation to the martial arts philosophy of the Jedi. The historical development of this philosophy begins with a Buddhist synthesis, with Taoism producing Zen and Kung Fu. This synthesis spread to Korea and Japan, and with it, the knowledge of Qi. The philosophy of the Force is thus best understood by way of understanding the nature of Qi and the wisdom of Zen. Looking, found someone you have. The origin of Qi-oriented martial arts in China is found in the teachings from the Shaolin Temple. It was here that Bodhidharma, who came from India to China in the 6th century, founded Chan, known in Japanese as Zen, and Kung Fu, a discipline that cultivates and directs the flow of Qi, applying it to fighting techniques. The Shaolin Temple was founded as a Buddhist monastery in 497 CE. When Bodhidharma arrived, he found that the monks were weak and in ill health and tended to fall asleep during meditation. China at the time was in a state of disunity, with competing military powers fighting one another and bands of bandits wandering the countryside. Buddhist monks in Central Asia had evolved a system of self-defense based in yoga and utilizing prana, a Sanskrit term, the meaning of which approximates qi. Bodhidharma came out of this tradition, integrating it with Taoist practice, and taught it to the Shaolin monks to promote health, mental discipline, self-defense, and spiritual awareness. The origin of Buddhism goes back 1,000 years before Bodhidharma to the teachings of Gautama Sakyamuni in northern India. As an advanced student of yoga, Gautama was principally concerned with liberation from the bonds of karma, which causes suffering. The idea is that one is subject to innumerable incarnations due to the conditions of karma. That is, past actions produce the conditions of the present moment, and what one does now determines the conditions of the future. In this, there is suffering due to ignorance of reality. With enlightenment, which is the meaning of the word Buddha, one comes to know reality and thus liberation from the chains of karma. Bodhidharma was in lineage of mind-to-mind transmission through 28 generations, beginning with Sakyamuni Buddha. At Shaolin, he transmitted this wisdom, which is the essence of Zen. The character of Yoda was created with Zen in mind. George Lucas envisioned a character one would find in traditional fairy tales or mythologies, like a frog or a wizened old man by the side of the road. The hero meets this character, thinking him to be insignificant, yet he holds the very wisdom the hero needs to fulfill his quest. Lucas learned from Joseph Campbell that underlying religious mythologies are archetypal patterns which reflect universal truth. Dig deeply enough into any of the great spiritual traditions, and one comes upon a reservoir of truth common to all and the source of each. Star Wars mythology is an intentional expression of archetypal truth. This truth is known through mystical experience. Campbell maintained that the Zen experience is the mystical wisdom which springs forth from the great reservoir of universal truth. Thus, Yoda is intended to be a motif for universal wisdom. When Luke Skywalker enters into Jedi training, he undergoes what Lawrence Kasdan, screenwriter for The Empire Strikes Back, envisioned as Zen education. He tells us that the stories I find most interesting are stories of Zen education and the Zen master teaching a pupil how to transcend physical prowess into some kind of mental prowess. That's what all the training sequences are about. Don't give in to hate. That leads to the dark side. When Buddhism was introduced to China, it entered into dialectic with Taoism, and the synthesis of Buddhism with Taoism produced the Zen philosophy. The notion of qi is rooted in Taoism, which teaches that the qi is manifested as yin and yang, the light and the dark, and that one must harmonize with this energy, which requires balance. Lucas said that the idea of positive and negative, that there are two sides to an entity, a push and a pull, a yin and a yang, and the struggle between the two sides are issues of nature that I wanted to include in the film. The word Tao, literally translated from the Chinese as way, and the philosophy of Tao is about the way of nature. Everything in nature exists in the field of opposites, up, down, left, right, in, out, male, female, light, dark, positive, negative, yang, yin, and so forth. The way of nature has a tendency toward balance, which is the great harmony known as Tai Chi, which literally means supreme ultimate. The so-called yin-yang symbol, a circle the inside of which is divided by a wavy line, one half being light with a dark dot, and the other half dark with a light dot, is properly called the emblem of Tai Chi. The white dot in the dark side and the dark dot in the light side symbolize the interdependence of opposites. In The Phantom Menace, Qui-Gon Jinn refers to the prophecy of the One who will bring balance to the Force, believing the One to be Anakin Skywalker. This implies something other than a duality of good versus evil. In Taoist thought, there is neither absolute good nor absolute evil, but rather good and evil are relative conditions of one another. As Obi-Wan puts it, "You're going to find that many of the truths we cling to depend greatly on our own point of view." From a Taoist point of view, it is not possible to have the light without also having darkness. Or in the language of Star Wars, one cannot exist without the dark side being ever present. When Anakin Skywalker becomes Darth Vader, he is seduced by the dark side. But in Return of the Jedi, his son Luke draws him back to the goodness. Anakin thus brings balance back to the Force in himself as well as to the galaxy by destroying the Emperor. Is it possible to be out of balance with too much goodness? The short answer is yes. The prequel trilogy outlines just such a condition where the Jedi Order finds itself in the smugness of complacency as the dark side is active right under their noses. The Jedi are living so much in the light of morality that the shadow of unconscious desire, symbolized by the Sith, takes on a life of its own, and like an unsupervised child, becomes delinquent. If one is out of touch with the shadow side of one's nature, one's dark side, it becomes pathological, like feeling lust or greed and living in denial, or otherwise becoming unconscious, such that it only magnifies itself in the repressed unconscious. This, it seems, is the lesson that Luke learns in the depths and darkness of the cave on Dagobah, in which he confronts his own dark side. Yoda teaches Luke that
a Jedi's strength flows from the Force, but beware of the dark side. Anger, fear, aggression, the dark side of the Force are they. Easily they flow, quick to join you in a fight.
Luke asks if the dark side is stronger.
No,
answers Yoda. But it is quicker, easier, more seductive.
Luke then asks, how am I to know the good side from the bad?
You will know when you are calm, at peace, passive. A Jedi uses the Force for knowledge and defense, never for attack.
According to Buddhist psychology, there are three poisons which produce the karma of suffering, attraction, repulsion, and ignorance. Attraction includes desire to have or possessiveness, greed, lust, and any other emotions of holding on or clinging to what is wanted. Anakin's excessive clinging attachment to his mother leads him into self-destructive hate and rage. The problem is not that he loves his mother, for that is good and natural, but his attachment, rooted in the fear of losing her, leads him to aggression when her death sends him into a rage and he slaughters a tribe of sand people, including women and children. Following this is his fear-based, ego-centered drive to be strong enough never to lose what he is attached to again, blaming his own weakness for his mother's death. He promises Padme,
I will be the most powerful Jedi ever.
Anakin thus suffers repulsion toward his own perceived weakness. Out of repulsion are generated fear, anger, hate, violence, and other such emotions. In The Empire Strikes Back, Vader prompts Luke to use his hate, and in Return of the Jedi, the Emperor goads,
use your aggressive feelings, boy. Let the hate flow through you.
Acting out such emotions leads to the dark side. Luke knows this and so encourages his father to let go of your hate, as doing so will lead Anakin back to the good that Luke has faith must still exist in him. Both attraction and repulsion are rooted in ignorance, which is the illusion of being an isolated individual ego. Buddhism teaches that there is no inherently substantial self. Everything is impermanent. All is in process, with everything changing, always flowing. Nothing is in isolation from the whole of this ever-changing process. Existence is not made of parts, but is a relative process of interdependence. As Obi-Wan says,
the Force binds the galaxy together.
And it's interesting to note that the one hero character who explicitly professes not to believe in the Force is named Han Solo, derived from the Latin for alone. The ignorance of egotism produces the negative karma of suffering. When one is constricted by one's ego, the emotions characteristic of the dark side are generated. In The Phantom Menace, Yoda warns Anakin,
fear is the path to the dark side. Fear leads to anger. Anger leads to hate. Hate leads to suffering.
Fear is the clinging of ego, of not realizing the oneness of life. Anger and hate follow. Sakyamuni Buddha said that he taught one thing and one thing only, how to be free from suffering. This freedom is the letting go of clinging to the ego. With this letting go, negative emotions dissolve into nothingness. When Yoda teaches Luke to know by way of being calm, at peace, passive, this is the teaching of Tao. In Taoism, and in the Tao of Zen, there is the practice of letting go and emptying. Lao Tzu writes in the Tao Te Ching, the core text of Taoism, that the Tao is to unlearn and to undo. Yoda says to Luke, you must unlearn what you have learned. In Chinese, this directive is called Wu Wei, which literally means no action. But a better translation would be effortless action or egoless spontaneity. When Yoda says to be passive, he does not intend for Luke to become inactive, for the Force is ever in motion, like water flowing in a river, passively in action, without effort. In the Japanese martial art of Aikido, effortless action is of the essence. The name Aikido means the way, do, of harmonizing or unifying I, the chi, ki. In order to use the ki, one must let go of effort. In the prequel trilogy,
One Jedi Master is named Ki Adi Mundi, which seems to be inspired by the name Aikido. When Obi-Wan begins to teach Luke the way of the Force, he says, "A Jedi can feel the Force flowing through him." When Luke asks if it controls your actions, Obi-Wan answers, "Partially, but it also obeys your commands." This is an important teaching of all of the Chi, Ki-oriented martial arts, and what differentiates them from gross fighting techniques. Great warrior? Wars not make one great. Buddhist monks traveling throughout China, Korea, and Japan shared their martial arts with worthy students. About a half century after the founding of Shaolin Kung Fu, the king of Silla on the Korean Peninsula invited Buddhist warrior monks to begin training an elite order of warriors to be known as Hua Rang. This order was to serve the kingdom, uphold justice, and maintain social order. They were a monastic order trained in not only martial arts, but also the healing arts, Taoist Chai Kung, the arts of political leadership and diplomacy, as well as Buddhist philosophy. Like the Jedi, the Hua Rang were chosen at a young age, trained to be pure of mind, and to follow a strict ethical code of loyalty, honor, and service. They were also given authority over the regular military in much the same way the Jedi are in Attack of the Clones. Buddhism was first introduced to Japan through Korea, and with it also the Buddhist martial arts forming the basis of jiu-jitsu. In Japan, the Sohei, an order of warrior monks much like the Hua Rang, was developed. They lived in mountain monasteries surrounding the imperial capital of Kyoto. Their considerable political power eventually put them at odds with the shogun, military ruler over the warrior class, the samurai, culminating in the 15th century when samurai destroyed the Sohei monastic complex, killing most of its monks, parallel to the way in which the Jedi are practically wiped out in Revenge of the Sith. A few Sohei went into hiding, blending in with non-militant monks, and over time, they taught their martial arts to other monks, and a few were the samurai. Eventually, Buddhist martial arts also became the core of samurai training. The indigenous religion of Japan is Shintoism, which centers around reverence for the ancestors and worship of the Japanese emperor as a divine incarnation. Traditional Japan was hierarchical, with the emperor and his family on top, then the nobility, and then the samurai. The common people were subordinate and submissive to this social structure. The word samurai means to serve. It was the role of the samurai to serve the good of the nation with honor and loyalty to the emperor, and with absolute obedience to his master, even unto death. The samurai had a strict code of conduct, known as Bushido, which means the way of the warrior. The code consists of general precepts, which are open-ended and fluid. Over time, it would integrate into itself much of the ethical teaching of Buddhism. The sword is the soul of a samurai. The relationship that a samurai has to his sword is much like a Jedi's relationship to his lightsaber. The name Jedi is derived from the samurai era of swordsmen called Jidai Geki, which literally means the era of play, referring to samurai-inspired settings or themes used in Japanese drama. The Jedi's kimono-style dress is loosely based on samurai clothing, with the addition of a medieval hood to give a more monkish motif. Vader's helmet and armor are based on those used by the samurai as well. Sword play in the original Star Wars trilogy reflects the way of sword called kendo, as derived from the samurai tradition. In the prequel trilogy, we see sword styles based more on kung fu. Zen master Takuan Soho wrote to a sword master giving advice on Zen and the art of swordsmanship. He advised to have a no-mind mindfulness. Do not let the mind stop, but keep it flowing. As soon as the mind stops, it localizes itself, thus becoming limited. Rather than localizing the mind, let it fill up the whole body. Let it flow throughout the totality of your being. Let it go all by itself freely and unhindered and uninhibited. Soho goes on to say that when the mind is nowhere, that is, when it does not stop at any location, it is everywhere. In Zen practice, one is with one's original mind, which is no mind. A mind that stops and localizes is a delusive mind that is divided against itself, thus interfering with the free working of original mind. When Obi-Wan tells Luke to let go of his conscious self and act on instinct, he is essentially advising to let go of the divided delusional mind and go with the original mind, which is the mind unconscious of itself. A mind unconscious of itself is a mind that is not at all disturbed by effects of any kind. The mind moves from one object to another, flowing like a stream of water, filling every possible corner. There is a story of a centipede that was asked how, with so many legs, he was able to walk. When the centipede began to think about it, he was not able to walk. The act of walking is simple without thought, but think about it, and it becomes impossibly complex. To master is to simplify. The swordmaster must act on no mind spontaneity. Takuin tells his student that his actions must be like sparks flying off flint struck by metal. There can be no delay, no hesitation. Attack and response must be in the same moment, such that no space and no time divide one thing from another. Zen swordmaster Teshu calls this the sword of no sword, in which he says, I naturally blended with my opponent and moved in unhindered freedom. Aikido is founded on this same philosophy. In fact, it is literally the art of the sword without the use of a sword. There is a story told about Morihei Ueshiba, the founder of Aikido, being unarmed, defending himself from a sword attack by a high-ranking swordsman, by avoiding the cuts and thrusts, until the swordsman gave up. In The Empire Strikes Back, when Luke is confronted with a task that he perceives as difficult, he declares, All right, I'll give it a try. To which Yoda responds,
No! Try not! Do or do not! There is no try!
So as long as there is effort, that very effort divides the mind against itself. When I try, the mind is divided between I and trying. With effort, there is division between the actor and what's acted upon. This division is a psychological fabrication that fragments the whole into parts, thus removing one from original mind. In Zen enlightenment, known in Japanese as Satori, there is the experience of undivided wholeness. Satori is what Zen is all about. Teshu is one of the greatest swordmasters. After his early training, he went for many years undefeated. Then he met Yoshiaki, whom he was not able to defeat. Although Yoshiaki was older and much smaller, he repeatedly forced Teshu to retreat. Teshu began to suffer from the image of this master as a great mountain bearing down upon him. This was for him like Luke's vision of Darth Vader inside the cave on Dagobah. And just as the real obstacle for Luke was his own mind, as revealed in the severed head of Vader exploding into the likeness of Luke's face, so is it for Teshu. Thus he went to a Zen master for help. If an opponent frightens you or confuses you, advised Zen master Gano, it means you lack true insight. Gano gave Teshu a koan for his zazen, Zen meditation practice. A koan is a problem to work on with zazen that cannot be solved on the level of thought. Some classic koans are, Show me your original face before your parents were born, and What is the sound of one hand clapping? To answer a koan, one must demonstrate insight which comes out of Satori. After years of Zen training, Teshu entered into a Satori, after which the threatening image of Yoshiaki vanished. When next he encountered Yoshiaki and they crossed swords, Yoshiaki withdrew his sword and declared, You have arrived. There was no further need to fight, for there was no enemy. When Luke says to Yoda, before he knows it is Yoda, that he is looking for a great warrior, Yoda asserts that, Wars not make one great. In like manner, Teshu only became a truly great warrior when he realized that in truth, there is no enemy. As a novice monk studying with Taizan Meizumi Roshi, a Japanese Zen master, I worked on a koan attributed to Bodhidharma. If you use your mind to study reality, you will understand neither reality nor the mind. If you study reality without using your mind, you will understand both. Axiomatic to Zen philosophy is the insight that conceptual understanding is illusory. A core assumption of Western thought is that one can use intellect to understand mind and reality. Zen asserts that this is not the case. True understanding is beyond all conceptualization. The mind is endlessly active in effort to achieve that which is impossible for it. Zen is a philosophy to undo philosophy, to study mind in reality with no mind. There is no end to asking why, and no way to give an intellectual answer that will be fully satisfactory. When Luke asks the why question, Yoda answers, "No, no, there is no why. Nothing more will I teach you today. Clear your mind of questions."
Chapter 4. Moral Ambiguity in a Black and White Universe. Richard H. Dees. The moral universe of Star Wars has two colors, black and white. In the opening moments of A New Hope, we find Darth Vader dressed all in black, confronting Princess Leia dressed in virginal white. Every identifiable character in the six movies works either for the light side of the Force or for the dark side. It's a world with very few shades of gray, much less of brighter, more interesting moral colors. In this galaxy, unlike our own, there seems at first glance to be no room for moral tragedy, for choices where no answer is morally correct, or for plain moral ambiguity. Nevertheless, moral ambiguity can be found lurking in the Star Wars universe, if we look for it. Often, important characters are first presented to us as morally ambiguous. When we meet them, we do not know whose side they are on in the war. But later, their true natures reveal themselves. We can, I think, learn some important moral lessons by looking at the ways characters like Han Solo or Lando Calrissian reason when we first meet them, and at the ways in which they turn towards one side or the other. There are also a few cases that are closer to real ambiguity, like Count Dooku and Anakin Skywalker. From both kinds of cases, we can learn how to think about moral problems more deeply and more intelligently. What good's a reward if you ain't around to use it? When we first meet Han Solo in A New Hope, he's a smuggler caught in the web of the crime lord Jabba the Hutt. He's arrogant and cocky, a scoundrel, as Leia puts it. His moral philosophy is unmitigated egoism. He only looks after himself. "I take orders from just one person, me," Han proclaims. He accepts the mission to Alderaan only for the exorbitant fee that Obi-Wan offers him, and he helps to find Princess Leia in the Death Star only because Luke promises him a large reward. Indeed, after even he rescues Leia, Han tells her, "I ain't in this for your revolution, and I'm not in it for you, Princess. I expect to be well paid. I'm in it for the money." As soon as he delivers the princess to the Rebel Alliance, Han takes his reward and departs, leaving Luke to observe bitterly, "Take care of yourself, Han. I guess that's what you're best at, isn't it?" Han sees no reason to accept any authority, moral or otherwise, outside his own self-interest. In his egoism in A New Hope, Han is equaled only by Jango Fett in Attack of the Clones, who is, as he puts it, just a simple man trying to make my way in the universe. But Jango is clearly a mercenary for hire, willing to assassinate a senator for a price, and even to sell his own genetic code for profit. His one act of apparent altruism is his obvious love for his son Boba, the clone of himself he insisted that the Kaminoans create for him. Although many parents love their children because they see themselves perpetuated in them, Jango's love for Boba carries this sentiment one step further towards mere narcissism. Han and Jango's view is a form of ethical egoism, the view that morally what I should do is what is in my interest to do. As the 17th century philosopher Thomas Hobbes argues, whatsoever is the object of any man's appetite or desire, that is it, which he for his part calleth good, and the object of his hate and aversion, evil. The only standard we can use for what is good, Hobbes says, is what we ourselves want. The world turns only by appealing to people's self-interest, and we should expect nothing else. Indeed, egoists argue, we are all better off in a world where everyone acts out their own self-interest than in a world where everyone is constantly interfering with others. While we may be tempted to think otherwise, egoism is not an incoherent view. The interests of the Ewoks may be to enjoy the natural beauty of the forest
and to live in harmony with other living things there, and those of the Empire may be to level the trees to create a base that will better protect the construction of the second Death Star. But the conflict that results isn't a logical contradiction. Each can still maintain that what they are doing is morally correct. It is, however, a practical contradiction since they can't both do what they want. Dedicated egoists argue we each have an interest in living in an ordered society where conflicts about trees do not lead to either violence or to ongoing hostility. And so we need to think about the interests of others to some degree if we want to promote our own interests in the long run. Indeed, an enlightened egoism that takes seriously what is needed to make society work will make a place for loyalty, dedication, and even charity. Egoists can also recognize that people's interests are directed not only towards themselves, but also towards their loved ones, their country, and even towards the environment. An enlightened egoism can, then, include much of what is usually considered moral. Han, unlike Django, shows the necessary dispositions for this better form of egoism. He shows, for example, genuine loyalty from the very beginning. His affection for Chewbacca is obvious from our first encounter with him, and he quickly develops an older brother's affection for Luke. Even more importantly, Han shows a capacity for something more. When Leia rebukes him, "If money is all you love, then that's what you'll receive." And then turns to Luke to add, "I wonder if he really cares about anything. Or anyone." Han is clearly hurt. When Luke chides him for refusing to join the rebel attack on the Death Star, Han looks obviously guilty, and Chewie reproaches him as only he can. So when Han claims that he rescues Luke from Darth Vader in the Death Star trench because, "I wasn't going to let you get all the credit and take all the reward," we know that he does it for Luke. Han demonstrates that loyalty once again on the ice planet Hoth. When no one is able to find Luke in the base, Han sets off to find him over the objections of the other rebels. By the time he rescues Luke against the odds, 725-1, R2 calculates, we have little doubt where his affections lie. Later, he delays his own escape from the planet to ensure that Leia can get off too. And when he's captured by Darth Vader on Bespin, he tells Chewie not to resist the Imperial forces because he needs him to take care of Leia. Unlike the narrowly egoistic Django, Han is capable of true and deep friendships. He is willing to risk all for both Luke and Leia. Yet even on Hoth and Bespin, his own affairs still take precedence. Despite the rebellion's need for his skills and his leadership, he tries to leave the rebels so that he can pay off Jabba. To think a bounty hunter will be able to capture him in the rebellion's secret hideout surrounded by loyal troops is simply implausible. When Leia argues truthfully, albeit to hide her own feelings even from herself, that we need you, Han's only interested in whether she needs him. And when they finally escape to Bespin, he's still set on abandoning the Alliance. Despite the overwhelming needs of others, Han still feels that he has to look after his own affairs, no matter what the cost to others. He still has no loyalty to the rebellion or to the greater good, and he's still quick to look after himself and his own affairs rather than the interests of others. At this point, then, Han is still an egoist, albeit an enlightened one. He cares for others, and so their welfare counts as part of Han's own self-interest. What they need is part of what he considers when he thinks about what he wants, and so he can then sometimes act for the sake of others. Moreover, Han's egoism has its limits. We could never imagine Han taking money to assassinate a political leader. With a broadened self-interest, Han is certainly better morally than he seemed when we first met him. But more is needed before he can acknowledge the moral value of something greater than himself. Yet, his friendships with Leia and Luke allow him to see the importance of the cause that they so easily embrace. His love for them eventually leads him to commit himself to a greater good and to express a moral regard for oppressed people everywhere. Following their moral examples, he becomes a full member of the Rebel Alliance and one of its most important leaders. By committing himself to a genuinely moral cause, he escapes his egoism. Or perhaps he does not so much escape his egoism as much as his self-interest becomes so broad that it encompasses all of morality. In any case, Han has been transformed from an arrogant and self-centered smuggler into a moral leader.
This deal is getting worse all the time.
At first glance, Lando Calrissian seems to be just like Han. Indeed, he and Han ran in the same circles earlier in their lives, and he lost the Millennium Falcon to Han in a card game. Like Han, Lando was a scoundrel. For that reason, we may be tempted to see his decisions as egoistic as well. Yet, when we meet Lando in The Empire Strikes Back, he is the administrator of Bespin, an independent mining colony. He has become, as Han puts it, a businessman, a responsible leader. Dealing with supply problems, labor difficulties, and the complexities of running a large enterprise, Lando understands is the price you pay for being successful. Yet even before we actually meet him, he has been confronted with a nasty moral dilemma. He can either betray his old friend Han and turn him over to Darth Vader, or he can allow Bespin to be overrun by Imperial stormtroopers. We might view Lando's decision as egoistic. He betrays Han to save his own neck. But Lando's decision is not so self-serving. The lives of everyone on Bespin will be made substantially worse if the Empire controls it. So Lando makes a fairly straightforward, utilitarian decision. Utilitarianism is the view that, as the 19th century philosopher John Stuart Mill puts it, actions are right in proportion as they tend to promote happiness, wrong as they tend to produce the reverse of happiness. While the egoist promotes only her own happiness, the utilitarian promotes the happiness of everyone. The correct moral action is the one that creates the most happiness for the world. The greatest happiness of the greatest number, to use the Jeremy Bentham's famous phrase. To determine the right act, we look at each of the options that are available to us and calculate the likely consequences of choosing that option. We then add up the happiness that would be created for every person affected if we choose that option and subtract the unhappiness. We then compare this result with those of the other options and then pick the one with the highest total. Every person's happiness or unhappiness is weighed equally in the calculation. So from a utilitarian point of view, the increased happiness of a large number of people usually outweighs the pain suffered by one. So when Lando gives up Han to prevent the great harms that his people would suffer if the Empire commands his colony, he is simply weighing the good of the many against the harm to one. In the context of The Empire Strikes Back, this decision looks like moral cowardice. We want Lando to stand up to the Empire and try to save his friends, no matter what the cost. With E.M. Forster, we think that, if I had to choose between betraying my country and betraying my friend, I hope I should have the guts to betray my country. We empathize so much with Han and Leia that we simply ignore the thousands of other people who are affected by Lando's decision. But to put it in these terms shows how narrow-minded such a judgment is. In fact, we expect the government to look after the welfare of the whole society rather than the needs of a single individual, within some limits, which can often be justified on utilitarian grounds. We expect government officials to act as utilitarians, maximizing the good for the whole community. Officials should think of the nation, and only incidentally of individuals, even if the individuals in question are personal friends of the leader. Indeed, especially if the individuals are personal friends. We expect governmental officers to go out of their way to avoid charges that they are acting out of their own interests, or those of their friends, rather than out of those of the nation as a whole. Imagine how we would judge the President of the United States if he were willing to give in to terrorist demands to save the life of an old hunting buddy from Mexico. Lando's actions would be exactly the same. He would be turning over the colony to the tyranny of the Empire, just to save a gambling buddy who does not even belong to the colony. Seen in this light, Lando's decision is not only reasonable, it's also what we would expect from someone in his position. Moreover, whatever Han thinks, Lando's choice is not between giving up Han and saving his colony. No matter what Lando does, Han will be captured by Darth Vader. Either Lando will surrender Han to Vader, or the stormtroopers will capture him in their assault on the planet. So Lando's real choice is only whether he is going to try to save the mining colony or not. The choice he actually faces is much like one discussed by the moral philosopher Bernard Williams. An evil commandant offers to save 19 of his 20 innocent captives, slated for execution, if you personally will shoot one of them, despite your own pacifist convictions. The captive you kill will die no matter what you do. So the question is whether you should act to save the other 19. Williams argues that a utilitarian morality, indeed any abstract morality, requires too much if it expects you to give up your own convictions to kill the one. Such a moral demand would violate your personal integrity, he claims. While Williams' position is appealing, it is ultimately based on a kind of moral selfishness. I will never get my hands dirty, though the heavens may fall. Undoubtedly, both you and Lando give up something important if you act as morality requires. You each give up a sense of moral purity. But ultimately, that sense is a kind of moral vanity. It is the view that my moral sensibilities are worth more than the lives of the others. Even if Lando and you don't entirely trust either Darth Vader or the Commandant to keep his word, the decision to try to help the many is not one of moral cowardice. Indeed, valuing the actual lives of others over your own moral scruples is an act of moral courage. Yet even if we think that this reasoning is faulty, and that in the final analysis Lando is wrong, we shouldn't judge him a coward. He's not acting in a clearly unreasonable or selfish manner. He simply weighs the moral options differently. In fact, Lando never really has any choice whatsoever. No matter what he does, the Empire is going to take over his colony, and Han is going to be captured. So his plaintive refrain, "I had no choice," is really true. But Lando doesn't act immorally for trying to produce a different outcome. To his credit, when he realizes that his goals are hopeless, he does what he can, both to evacuate as much of the colony as possible and to save Leia, Chewie, and 3PO from Vader. After losing his colony, he doesn't think of himself at all. He immediately joins Luke and Leia's plans to rescue Han, and we see him at the end of The Empire Strikes Back, setting off to find Han on Tatooine. He thus immediately tries to make right the harm that was done to Han through his actions, even if that harm was caused by no fault of his own. And once he has rescued Han, he doesn't hesitate to join the rebel forces in what looks like a suicide mission to attack the second Death Star. Far from being a narrow egoist, Lando is in fact one of the most morally courageous figures in the Star Wars saga.
Together, we can destroy the Sith.
Count Dooku is first introduced in Attack of the Clones as a political idealist, not a murderer. Dooku is a former Jedi who leads a separatist rebellion against the Republic. The case for rebellion that Dooku presents to Obi-Wan is compelling.
What if I told you that the Republic was now under the control of the Dark Lord of the Sith? Hundreds of senators are now under the influence of a Sith Lord called Darth Sidious.
Dooku's argument is that the Republic is under the control of a Senate that has been hopelessly corrupted by an agent of evil. The only chance to destroy the Sith, he argues, is to break with the Republic completely and to undermine the power of the Senate. In other words, the only choice is to join him. Obi-Wan, of course, refuses to believe that the Jedi Council could be so thoroughly deceived about the power that the Sith Lord wields, and so he sees Dooku only as a traitor. Here's an interestingly ambiguous scenario. We have two characters, each of whom is acting on what he thinks is best for everyone. We know Obi-Wan better, so we're more likely to trust his judgment. But we also know that the information provided by Dooku is accurate. Dooku sees a corrupt government, controlled by pure evil. Rebellion, he thinks, is the only possibility of keeping the galaxy from falling under the complete sway of those hidden forces. Although Obi-Wan objects to this possibility, we can easily imagine that Dooku would be joined by an independently minded Jedi like Qui-Gon Jinn, who was only too eager to ignore the advice of the Jedi Council with respect to Anakin Skywalker. On the other hand, because Obi-Wan completely trusts the capacity of the Jedi Council to detect the Sith, he sees only a rebel, looking after his own interests and those of his cronies. The only evil he sees is that of the Separatist rebellion itself. However much Obi-Wan's intentions are good, he fails to see the greater danger. His arrogance in his own knowledge and in that of his leaders leaves unquestioned his misguided assumptions. Dooku understands that the dark side of the Force has clouded there the Jedi Council's vision, and he knows that drastic action is needed to avert catastrophe, so he's willing to take enormous risks for the good of all. We have, then, a conflict between people with different views of what is needed to advance the good, neither of whom is in a position to convince the other of his point of view. The dispute is a conflict of visions, based partially on a conflict in knowledge. Each man acts reasonably given the information he has, relying most on those whom he trusts. Each is thus acting out of good intentions, yet one must have unwittingly become a tool of evil. Without further information, such conflicts can't be resolved, and so one of them must be horribly mistaken. In such scenarios lie great moral tragedies. To be a great tragedy, however, each side must be acting out of goodwill, but one unwittingly adds evil. Unfortunately, such an interestingly ambiguous scenario is not the one we actually find in Attack of the Clones. By the time we see him with Obi-Wan, we already know that Dooku is no idealist and that he does not have any good intentions. The Trade Federation will join the Separatists only if Padme Amidala has been eliminated, and Dooku has assured Newt Gunray that his hired assassin, Jango Fett, will not fail. His participation shortly thereafter in the attempt to execute Obi-Wan, Padme, and Anakin leaves us no room to think that he was ever acting for good. The later revelation that Dooku is actually the Sith apprentice, Darth Tyrannus, is thus hardly surprising. It is merely an irony that Dooku exercises his deception by telling an important truth, while Obi-Wan later conveys a deeper truth by lying to Luke about the death of his father. Dooku, as it turns out, is not morally ambiguous at all. He's simply a subtle instrument of evil. The movie thus misses an opportunity to teach us an important moral lesson. Sincere people can honestly disagree about the correct moral course. I'm a Jedi. I know I'm better than this. On the face of it, the most morally ambiguous character in the Star Wars saga must be Anakin Skywalker. He changes from an innocent and good-hearted young boy into a servant of the Emperor, the embodiment of darkness itself. But I think that Anakin is not in fact so ambiguous. As a child, Anakin is clearly on the side of good. He reaches out to Padme and Qui-Gon on Tatooine, offering them shelter from a sandstorm. Hearing their troubles, he immediately seeks to help them, risking his own life in the Bunta Eve pod race to win the prize money that Qui-Gon needs to buy the spare parts for their damaged starship. In The Phantom Menace, Anakin is nothing but innocence and goodness. No moral ambiguities here. As a young man, however, Anakin becomes Darth Vader by A New Hope. He is, as Obi-Wan puts it, more machine now than man, twisted and evil. No moral ambiguities there either. We might then expect to see some signs of ambiguity in the interim. But in Attack of the Clones, we never see the kind boy we met on Tatooine. Not once during the entire movie does he show basic compassion. He's rude, arrogant, and ungrateful. When he talks about the respect he has for Obi-Wan's wisdom, he never acts as if he believes that Obi-Wan has anything to teach him. He ignores Obi-Wan's explicit instructions at every opportunity. He picks a fight with Obi-Wan in front of Padme to prove his loyalty to her over his teacher. He refuses to listen to Obi-Wan while chasing Zam Wessel, and he abandons his mission to Naboo to look after his own personal affairs. His smarmy resistance to Obi-Wan's teachings turns his otherwise patient and kind master into a hectoring nag. His pursuit of his love for Padme, while understandable, jeopardizes not only their careers, but also their lives, not to mention the lives of those who find themselves in the path of their recklessness. The only step he takes that seems selfless is his attempt to save Obi-Wan on Geonosis, but his actions are ill-conceived and rash, an ill-advised attempt to make up for abandoning his post earlier. His duty was clearly to protect his charge, yet he allows Padme to convince him to do what he himself wants to do. Once there, he has to be reminded to keep his mission when Padme falls out of their gunship, and he rushes into combat with Count Dooku so carelessly that he ends up causing unnecessary injuries to both Obi-Wan and to himself. Most of these actions are thoughtless rather than intentionally immoral, so we may be inclined to see them as well-intentioned, if mistaken. Even so, their sheer stupidity makes them morally defective. The problem is not that he acts on his emotions. Emotions play an important role in our moral evaluations. The 18th century Scottish philosopher David Hume even argues, "Morality is more properly felt than judged of." Yet even Hume thinks that reason plays an important role in morality.